One great thing about summer is how everything feels a bit more relaxed. The days are more relaxed, and I find myself reaching for the same comfortable go-anywhere pieces again and again. And that's why I keep going back to Quince. They focus on well-made essentials that naturally become those everyday staples you actually live in all season long. Quince's 100% European linen pants and shirts are breathable, easy to throw on, and a great summer upgrade starting as low as $34. Their tees are soft enough to live in all day, and the lightweight cotton sweaters are exactly what you want when the summer nights cool down. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands, and they work directly with ethical factories to cut out the middleman, so you're paying for exceptional quality, not brand markup. I used Quince recently to replace some of my old swimsuits and shorts for the summer, and I was pleasantly surprised that they're not only comfortable, but look great. And my wife was very happy to see me finally get rid of some of the old ones that I bought possibly back in the days of MySpace. So stop overcomplicating your wardrobe, because you don't need a closet full of options. You just need a few pieces that actually work. Make your summer wardrobe easier. Go to quince.com/40klore for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/40klore for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/40klore. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. One of the great things about the last quarter century is that we talk much more openly about our mental health than ever before. Being honest about how we're really doing, and when we're struggling, we don't hide it as much anymore. But for a lot of people, the part of asking for help is still a challenge. According to BetterHelp's 2026 State of the Stigma report, they surveyed 2,000 Americans and found 85% of them believe getting support is a good idea, but 74% felt that society discourages people from doing so. That's something we can all pitch in to fix. Not only should we be encouraging our friends and family to seek help when they need it, but we should be celebrating with them when they do so. This is something I know I do in my personal life a lot, and I encourage as many of you to do it as you can. This is the best way to pull the stigma away from therapy, which drives more people to access it. With BetterHelp, you can be matched with quality therapists with care and reliability. BetterHelp does all the initial matching for you, so you can focus on your therapy goals. BetterHelp is one of the world's largest online therapy platforms, with over 30,000 therapists and having served over 6 million people globally. Don't let the stigma stand in the way of support. Start therapy with BetterHelp. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com. That's better, H-E-L-P.com.
Welcome to the 40K Lorecast.
Welcome to the 40K Lorecast. It's me, John Barsotti, and Brad Chester.
This guy.
All right. Today, we'll be continuing our coverage of the Word Bearers and from their role in the outbreak and then the acceleration of the Horus Heresy. Jumping around a little bit, because Erebus and Lorgar start to see the future of the galaxy in different paths. Same finish. Different path.
I'm about to get that for sure on that.
Yeah. Now, 40K Lorecast, as always, weekly show in the Warhammer 40K universe. So releasing every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Please follow and comment. It helps our algorithm. It pushes us out to more listeners, and just we enjoy reading them, especially the negative comments about Brett, or actually, and about me, if I'm being honest. We both enjoy reading people's comments about the other one. We're competitive people, and we're the kind of really good friends who enjoy watching other people crap on the other one. It's a sign of a good friendship. What? If you like us, though, also check out our YouTube channel. There's a link in addition to Brad's new YouTube channel. Was that new, but newly used YouTube channel where he's doing a lot more coverage of the Warhammer 40K tabletop game. If you guys looking for some advice, great place to go for that. Also have links to my other show, Retro Recall, where I think time of recording, I might be on D&D at this point. I think when this releases, it might be me playing the Gold Box games. Remember those?
Yeah.
I still
played all of them. By the way. They're awesome. I play them annually. Like, I don't know why. I randomly be like, oh yeah, I can still use the stops.
Bullmaster Beholder Core.
Yeah.
Most ridiculous encounters in all of gaming, because you have no business and there's just a arena of beholders.
Yeah. It's literally why I had the tattoo on my shoulder of the beholder disintegrating the warrior. It's because of that game.
Yeah, dude.
Anyway.
God, what a crazy encounter.
Those games are nuts. All right. But if you want to help us out and support us, two great ways to do it. You can pick up our merchandise. As Brad learned last week, we have stickers. Been there for 6 months. But Brad learned that. In addition, we've got wine glasses.
I did confirm they are on a second page. Thank you very much. For me, at least.
Of two.
Yeah. I'm not wrong.
Thanks for putting in the full effort.
I was not wrong on my first thing I said. Second page.
There are of two pages.
They were on the second page.
I like the effort you put into these things. But if you want to put actual effort into supporting us, you can also join our Patreon. Our Patreon's a great way to support us. Also, Patreon's a great way to support anybody. Well, not if they suck. Don't do that. But if you like somebody, there's a lot of a-holes with Patreons where I'm like, no. But
Patreon's a really cool way to support artists. I love that you just gave everyone that listened to us the excellent advice of, hey, don't give money to people you don't like. Write it down, everybody.
Well, it's because everyone begs for Patreon. I won't beg for this money. I just say, hey, if you want to help us out, it'd be cool. If you don't, it's also cool.
You know who is, though? Brad Sellout Chester.
Oh, yeah. Brad Sellout Chester would happily. Oh, God. The level of crap you would schlep late night. Oh, my God. This is Brad Chester for like paintonhair.org. What I love doing for the public
is
I like to paint on my hair. It comes with multiple roller brush widths for convenience. Yeah.
Yeah. 2 a.m. That's all you'd see. It's me and
Bill's got to get paid. Anyway.
Yes.
I know why. I'm aware. If you want to support us on the Patreon, though, you do get this show and the history of 40K completely ad-free. It's $4.99 or 4.35 euros because sometimes I like to feel highfalutin and I want to drink me some gold. So today we are doing Gdansk. They're the maker of Goldwasser. Or as we call it in the rest of the world, Goldschlager, which, on a side note, why even do that renaming? I want to believe there was some Eastern European who was like, oh, the rest of the world, they couldn't pronounce something as complicated as Goldwasser. So we'll make it easy to pronounce Goldschlager. Because who can't pronounce Schlager? What could go wrong here? But Gdansk. Gdansk has a mild historical significance in that it was called Danzig, and then the Treaty of Versailles separated it out. And then in 1939, Germany felt no to that, and to which England said, the hell you do, World War II. But Gdansk has a interesting history. They actually, two different times in history, an independent state, although one time was like 7 years. But they look better than Vatican City, though, because at least they're not landlocked. Vatican City is weird because it's landlocked. You're just surrounded by the other country. At least Gdansk can technically get out to the coastline. Gdansk is also famous because that's one of more than 10 different names for the city. I can actually pronounce maybe a few of them. Gdansk, Dankazik, Dankazik. Sorry. And to any of our Polish listeners, in case I just said something really offensive, sorry? Like, I don't know. It's not my language. But like a lot of parts of Europe, Gdansk was first populated during the Stone Age because the region is fertile. So that's where you settle because, you know, food good, not food bad. But it was formally settled around the 10th century as the first Polish. Yeah, it's important, guys. You want to live where there's food and water. Key step. It's also why desert islands, bad.
Now, gems are flowing today, baby.
I am here. John had a boozy lunch, so we may not be as highfalutin of the information as we've been another time. So I'll be honest, the place I went serves very tall ciders, and I realized afterwards the cider was 8%. So we're going to party today. Now, Romans did settle it for a period of time, but the Romans kind of just put settlements everywhere. In the 10th century, the very first Polish state came into being, and Gdansk was a key part of it, given that it's coastal. It's most of its history, like a lot of places there, from the 10th to 16th century fluctuated. But in the 16th century, Gdansk gained a lot of economic power because since it was coastal, the distribution of grain and timber from the rest of the region went through there. So they became incredibly wealthy during that era, which then meant when the Industrial Revolution hit, they had the money to invest. So the city actually had trains, manufacturing, all that stuff. And it became a very major city to the Prussian Empire, who called it Danzig, who's, I mean, obviously, I have a Misfits tattoo, so we'll move on with our day there. Last little fun facts of Gdansk. Couple famous people from there. One, Johannes Calvinius was there. So he's the guy, he actually mapped the moon with a telescope, which is effort, and found, I think, over 11 constellations. But more importantly, Daniel Gabriel Fahrenheit is from there. You're a dick, dude. It is impossible.
In the only measurement
temperature it is.
Of temperature that you it should makes use.
No sense. It is. That's the hardest part of being American, is when I have to talk to my European colleagues and explain to them what things are here.
I really like talking about it because I like saying that, hey, we were at blah, 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 and it was 99 degrees. And people look at me and go, the earth ended? What happened? Yeah.
The better one, though, is actually if you want something funny, like for now, let our Canadian listeners fill us in. Look up how Canada flips between the metric and imperial system.
Sorry, Canada, you guys are nuts about that.
It's also random. There's a good flow chart you can find. But anyway, Polish food, I do like it a lot, especially pierogies. But I will say, and this is a note to everybody, stop breading your meat and then frying it. Just cook your damn meat. I don't need schnitzel. I don't need kotlet szalpoy. I don't need milanese. I don't need karote. I don't need filet empanado. I don't. Just cook the damn food. Pork chop, chicken, and yeah, I don't eat fried chicken. Sorry, I just don't like it. I like chicken. I love chicken.
Communist.
But fried chicken? Fried chicken's, just cook the damn chicken. Chicken. It's delicious. Have rotisserie chicken. You go to Costco, and if those of you who aren't in America, I'm sorry, you missed out on this one. But you go to Costco, get a rotisserie chicken, no one said. No one said. Unless you don't eat meat, in which case, yeah, fine. But Discord. Join our Discord. Link in the show notes. Easy to join. Fantastic spot. Great place for lore. Great place for literature. Great place for telling me all the things I get wrong. Brad probably too. The really wonderful spot to interact. We are extremely proud of our totally free Discord that anyone can join.
Psycho.
And not pay for. Just saying. No paywall. Because there shouldn't be. It's Discord. And come on in, join it. The community is getting really good, especially now that 11th edition is launching. We're seeing a lot of people asking questions about, hey, how do I play this game? I'm reading this rule. What's it mean? And no one's calling them an idiot or an asshole for asking the question. Instead, it's a, yes, let me answer that question and explain to you why it matters. You know, the way you're supposed to handle when someone says, I don't know this. Can someone please help me? Instead of yelling at them for being not as big of a nerd as you are. All right. But let's start off with our cast with Brad being wrong.
And you know what the best part about this cast is going to be? Me getting to wax poetically about the destruction of multiple ultramarine lands.
It was one.
It's multiple.
And also,
they broke the star. They built them back.
Yeah, fair enough. They built them back later. Well, not that one.
Yeah, except for one.
Call didn't go well. Well, but let's start about why. Yeah. Let's get into like hammering home how wrong Brad was about the Warrior God Lodge being a bad idea. I mean, like real wrong. This is a hill he tried to die on, and it's going to be like Getty's little round top and big round top for my, you know, American history buffs. So around 60 years before the outbreak of the heresy, there was this pivotal conflict on the world being brought into imperial compliance. And it was a world of warriors. The warriors on this planet all were broken up into segments. Each of them, they worshipped a different animal entity, for lack of a better phrase, like a serpent, for example. And I say that because the world is called Davin.
Nothing bad happened to Davin.
Yeah. And the Legion's brought
to compliance. It's a pleasure world now.
Yeah. Gavin, no negatives. Zero. The two, let's see, no issues here. The two Legions that did the compliance were the Luna Wolves and the Word Bearers. And the Luna Wolves, they were successful, but it was a lot of cost because the Warriors of Devon put up way more resistance than either thought that they could. And both the legionaries of both legions took notice. And they realized that the Warriors of Devon fought together with a higher level of cooperation than the legions had seen elsewhere.
It also, their battle coordination was like they could read each other's minds whilst they were immediately reacting to things on the battlefield.
Yeah. Now, the Luna Wolves and the Word Bearers are both like, oh, it must be because of these great, you know, warrior
lodges
they had. Yeah, it wasn't. It's because they were chaos worshippers, goddamn morons. That's why they were able to coordinate so well. They were chaos worshippers and the chaos gods were flowing through them.
Yeah.
That's how it goes. We try to make a chaos planet. But anyway, people are stupid. These things happen. So Erebus uses this, though, as a great opportunity for him. Why don't we work on more better warrior bonds? So the lodges are the design of Erebus. Doing great, Brad.
He does.
Doing great.
So he uses them for some nefarious means. That's
these are a terrible idea. The idea behind the Warrior Lodge is that it's a place where all legionnaires can sit, not as rank and file, but as equals and talk with each other. And yeah, what a great idea. Except in reality, they were secret societies because that's what this exactly is. And this doesn't align well with military culture for a reason, because the emperor had his own things. So as a result, the warrior lodges, because they are a big, big no-no, are a secret warrior lodge, which is what, of course, they would be if you're talking about having a bunch of people sit around, quote unquote, as equals. I don't know why you watched the movie Eyes Wide Shut, but this is a good idea.
I was waiting for my invitation to that party.
Hasn't come yet?
No.
Not a lot of them. To be fair, I don't want to go to Eyes Wide Shut, Toledo.
That's hearing, you know, hurtful talk.
Just, I assume it's next to the catalytic converter reseller.
And the kindergarten fight.
That kindergarten fight was impressive. The issue with the warrior lodges, though, calling out realistically, is that they were not public. So all of the members were secret, and only the members knew of the other members. And they also met in secret. The warrior lodges were...
Yeah, I'll give the thing. Loken in the books gives the best quote, which is, if you're willing to keep this secret from your brothers, what other secrets are you willing to keep? Basically, if you're not willing to share something because you're ashamed of it, you know, and they tried to talk around it, but...
Don't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's because Loken realized what they really were, which was that these were a nefarious organization meant to undermine the Imperium. Because Erebus's real goal was twofold. First, he was using them to sow the seeds of betrayal. You're getting members to discuss all their displeasures with the Imperial war machine. And by proxy, the Emperor. He's trying to start sowing that like doubt and that distrust.
I think the second part is the bigger part, though, because he was trying to figure out, okay, who's not receptive to this heresy so we can mark it down so we can get rid of them when shit goes down.
The warrior lodges are maybe the most important element. I actually think they're more important than Horus getting stabbed by a Tember, because without them, the heresy falls apart because you have internal conflict. This is what allowed Erebus to do and Horus do everything. So
also he's so comically evil with, I don't care what he's drawn at. Also, have you ever seen all of the artwork for Erebus is supposed to be Erebus after, you know, he's full chaos, but he looks full crazy from the get go. Also,
Erebus wasn't great.
I think he's still got a comical bad guy mustache. I mean, he doesn't in the things, but I'll put it on him.
Bad guy mustache.
Yeah, 100%. Just twirling it.
He is.
He tells you everything he tells you while he's got a woman tied to railroad tracks.
So let's get into Erebus just being kind of a dick.
Kind of?
After being made the War Master, Horus continues his campaign of compliance because he has no issue with it. I'm War Master. Emperor's back at home. I'll do what I'm supposed to do.
We talked about it forever ago in our Horace Heresy cast and stuff like that. One of the many reasons that this was even able to be done is this is also when Horace is declared the War Master, the Emperor deuces out from the crusade. He is radio silent. No one knows what's going on. This is how they were able to spread all this distrust and everything else. None of this is even possible until the Emperor goes home. Until he starts his Webray project and everything else, none of this is possible. I just want to set the stage for this because otherwise you're like, why wouldn't the Emperor just go, no, stop it? You know, that's why, because he's not here anymore. And he's not answering calls basically either. He's busy.
Yeah. And so as Horace does this campaign, a few different worlds fall to compliance. Some go well, some don't, whatever. They eventually hit this kingdom of the Itarax. And the Itarax... All right.
You've talked about them. I love the fact that you hate them so much.
I hate this so much because it's just stupid. All right. They are a human descended species. They are humans, but they have bat ears because their language is music and sounds. So they needed bigger ears. Figure that one out, guys. Good luck with that. I look forward to it. Bats have big ears.
I love that you're so bent off the evolution. You're like, now let me talk to you about magic.
It is. Because it's just lazy. That's my thing. The whole thing, because the problem is, I do these tasks. I know all the rules.
I think they get force evolved by chaos powers.
How could they be? How could that be? They fight chaos.
I think because of where they are.
The Itarax, that's only my thing about the Itarax is the Itarax would have been everyone had cloning technology. It's how we settled. So it means the AI running the cloning, the thing we had with the Kin and the Votan, would have gone bat ears. They need bat ears so that they can talk via song, which also, what's this music? But I think of it as song. So I want the Itarax to be really annoying where all they do is sing. When you visit the Itarax, you enter a musical at all times.
So they always sing to you.
Yeah. Is it South Park where they do that? Where it's like everyone just starts singing. Oh no, it's not South Park. It's is it Blazing Saddles? Damn it. It might be Blazing Saddles. It's definitely a Mel Brooks film.
Multiple times they've done that kind of stuff.
It's definitely a Mel Brooks film where people keep singing like, no, stop it. And I think it was a Mel Brooks film. It could be Blazing Saddles. It's not Spaceballs.
Itarax is, but anyway. They're big, by the way. Itarax have an empire, basically.
Right. Yeah, they have 30 star systems. And more important, this is why I don't think they're aligned with chaos. They're fully aligned with the Eldar.
I don't think they're aligned with chaos. I actually think that they got... Brad theory, I think they got manipulated by chaos. I don't think they're aligned with chaos at all. I think they get eliminated. There's a bunch of stuff that happens because of them. It leads to the Horus Heresy.
I just think it's poor writing. And they were like, yeah, they communicate with music. I have normal ears. You know what I can hear? Music. It's not that complicated. I don't sit there and say, if only my ears were bigger, then I could really hear the music
better.
But
you can hear more tones. You can go farther.
No. Your ear size has nothing to do with that. That's entirely the actual cognitive function of your brain based off the vibration of your inner ear. That's how that works.
I think the big ear helps a lot because it looks cool.
It doesn't.
The rule of cool always applies, John.
The entire people look like Bat Boy.
Yeah, some people might think that's cool.
The important part of the Itarax is that they've aligned themselves with the Eldar and they are fervently anti-chaos. The point, they've actually already destroyed quite a few hostile Xenos chaos aligned species. And they do a good job of this. However, they pose a couple problems for Horus. Problem number one, they're Xeno lovers, obviously.
Well, they are full on allies with Eldar.
Yeah, so Horus has an issue of, this is a big no-no. But second of all, they've got a pretty nice collection of relics from their conquests, including chaos-infused relics. Now, Horus doesn't know what those are, but there's one person around Horus who does. And I like to think of this more as, because the first thing you read it, you're like, well, why didn't they just destroy the relics? I think of it more as a D&D thing. There's stuff in D&D that if a relic is cursed so heavily, if you try to destroy it, the curse just goes on you. So all you can do is just leave it in inventory and drop it somewhere, but because you can't actually destroy it. So that's how I like to look at some of their collection. But Horus's problem is that they own 30 star systems, and it's not by chance. They can fight. They can really fight. So Horus wants to use diplomacy. He's going to see if he can convince them to somehow honor this. That story is for a different cast. The one that matters is Erebus. Erebus is with Horus when they visit the Edorex. And Erebus looks around the Edorex and goes, oh, I hate you guys. I really hate you. You've killed a bunch of my friends, all these things. Because they are in pure opposition of his goals.
They have all of the things that he needs to achieve his goals, though, including themselves and, well, a wildly cursed, a whole bunch of cursed weapons, but especially the Ananthemate.
Which is annoying because it's the Ananthemate. Ananthemate comes up a lot, by the way, but all right. It's the Ananthemate, which is a blade cursed by Nurgle, where if you speak a name into it and then stab that person with it, they get a uncurable poison that's an incredibly painful death. So Erebus sneaks away and steals that. The Itarex did not miss that. And it's a fun scene in the book where Horus and team discover that the Eldar can appear out of nowhere. And also all of the weaponry the Itarex has looks like regular, just normal like stuff. Doesn't look like a gun, but it's a gun and it will melt the space marine. So Horus has to retreat, and they flee the system of the Itarex. It's not clear how Erebus pulls this off, by the way, because he snuck in, stole the blade, and then takes the blade to Davin and gets back to Horus without anyone knowing.
Then he also goes down, sneaks down, and gives it to Temba, the planetary governor, sneaky.
With no one noticing. So I have to assume the Chaos Gods helped quite a bit, because Eugene Temba, who is the planetary governor of Davin, he has a lot of aspirations for himself. So when Erebus hands him a sword saying, this will put you in charge, he goes, all right, cool.
And for all the D&D people, I love this because I'm going to go old school on this. The id and the ego of that weapon, he instantly gets possessed. Like,
planet.
Yeah, that's true. But I'm saying he touches it and immediately fails every roll.
Very much so. He's just rolling all ones. It's all ones, nonstop ones. And the result is, for those who haven't read this, the Temba falls to chaos and actually gets infused by Nurgle, so making him quite the powerhouse, but also the entire planet gets overtaken by Nurgle. So when Horus gets to Davin to put it down, because this is a pretty serious revolution for him.
It's a plague planet at that point in time.
Yeah, exactly. They talk about they're walking through, they can't figure out why their feet feel heavy, and it's because they're walking through decaying everything. Just walking through decay as they go through it. Eventually, Horus meets with Eugene Temba, who looks like a normal dude, but fights like a demon, which he does.
Yes, he is.
And Eugene stabs Horus. At this moment, Lorgar, Erebus, and Corferon, this is their chance. Horus is dying, painfully dying. And they convince the Luna Wolves to let them take Horus to the Serpent Lodge on Davin, where they can use, non-traditional, air quotes there, healing methods.
Holistic methods.
Yeah, we're going to rub some sage on him to heal him. While this happens, Horus goes into his kind of fever dream where the Chaos Gods begin tempting him. Erebus knows this is basically the most important moment of his life. And as a result, he uses psychic powers to astrally project himself into Horus's dream. But he appears not as Erebus, but as a guy named Hoster Sejanus. Does he die in the first book? I think it's the first book, you guys.
He dies right before this, though. It's very soon.
Yeah, I can't remember. I think he dies like the opening of the first book, if I'm not mistaken. But he was one of Horus's favorite people, basically, and he dies on a diplomatic meeting gone wrong. So Horus is looking at a former good friend and confidant who's actually Erebus, and Erebus uses this to soften Horus's stance against the Chaos Gods, because Horus was willing to die. he was willing to just let this be the end of him. All right, this happens. Magnus tried to help out. He was useless. So Erebus steers him like, you don't have to die yet.
Yeah, and the things is they used, we talked a lot about this in the our things about the Horus Heresy. If you go back, it's one of my favorite casts. One of my favorites is the Chaos Gods knew exactly what buttons to push with the help of Erebus, hugely with the help of Erebus on this, because they went into hubris and his pride and everything else. Is Horus willing to die? Yes, but you've been betrayed. The entire galaxy will fall to ruin unless you rise up and do the right. That's how they started. He eventually just became a Chaos Pawn.
Exactly.
Overjuiced Chaos Pawn. But in the beginning, they were giving him all the, you're the only one that can do it. And because of the fact that he had a huge amount of pride and everything, he was like, of course it is. You know, I'm the War Master. I wouldn't have been chosen unless I was the best. And
and so as we get into the Horus Heresy, this is a big inflection point, though. And this is because Erebus takes on a much more significant role than Lorgar. And this is because they end up with different goals.
We'll be right back after a quick break. Have you been sitting on an idea for a while now? Have a concept for a business, but just have not pulled the trigger yet? Welcome to us and in this podcast about 2 years before we started with a bunch of, hey, we should start a podcast. And the good news is starting a business is easier than ever now, thanks to tools out there like Shopify. With Shopify, you get all the tools you need to start a business and make it successful. You get the experience of a global commerce platform representing 10% of all e-commerce business in the U.S. alone. You get built-in tools that'll help you grow between writing product descriptions, page headlines, even advice on photography. And all of this comes with 24/7 customer support to help you with your journey. Take your passion and get your side gig going. Speaking from experience, you won't regret it. Get started today with a free trial at shopify.com/lore. With Shopify, nothing stands between your ideas and a real business. So go make one. Start your free trial today at shopify.com/lore. Let's start your trial today at shopify.com/lore.
In my professional life, one thing I know well is how challenging managing a global team can be. Just the act of creating one has been an extreme challenge over the years. Because one thing you learn quickly is the difficulty of hiring global talent and how unclear those costs can be. It looks simple at first, but then the fees start to stack up with compliance worries, contractors versus employees, and a host of other regulations. Pebble brings clarity with upfront, all-in hiring costs and enables you to hire the world. Pebble is an AI-powered human resource platform built for founders, HR leaders, and operators who are hiring and supporting teams around the world. Pebble helps you hire, pay, and manage talent in over 185 countries, with fast onboarding that can be done in minutes. Instead of juggling separate tools for contracts, payroll, benefits, and compliance, Pebble brings everything together with built-in compliance and local expertise to support you. This is especially helpful if you're managing teams internationally or planning to grow. The fastest growing companies in the world use Pebble to stay organized and reduce risk. And founders use it to scale faster without feeling like they need to become HR compliance experts. Bottom line, it simplifies global people operation so you can spend more time growing the business and supporting your team. Pebble's new standard discounted pricing is only $399 per month per employee. That'll help you contain costs. Go to hipebble.ai to get a free estimate. That's hipebble.ai for a free estimate.
On the last cast, we closed out talking about how Lorgar was told by effectively Chaos, your role is to lead the people to us. As a result, this is my interpretation. I think Lorgar always believed the heresy would just succeed because the Chaos Gods are so powerful. Of course they'll win. And that's also why I don't like him. He's kind of naive as a character, but I think he annoys a lot of people because he's naive. He really believes.
I'll give you that.
It'll just work itself.
I actually think that he was really going down.
He shifts.
He goes.
Well, he shifts 100%
later. Yeah. Yes, but right at the time, I still think that he thinks he's doing what has to be done.
Yes, I'll give you that. I think originally Lorgar thought he was saving humanity by taking humanity to chaos. He didn't want that. Erebus, on the other hand,
no, I think he knows
everything. Fully understands.
He knows he knows the face of evil, and he is 100% okay with it and willing to embrace it. That's why he is the ultimate villain on that. I still think he's such, that's why I hate him, because he is responsible for all these things that happen.
And that's why I think, that's why I start seeing this bifurcation between the two of them. Because Lorgar just believes, of course we're going to win. Why wouldn't we win? There's no reason for us not to not win. Whereas Erebus goes, no, the Chaos Gods are not powerful enough to win this. The Emperor will win this if we don't do something. And Erebus knew the force of Chaos will fracture and will struggle, whereas the force of the Imperium will be single of purpose. So Erebus begins to work really hard to not only steer the heresy, but to create a lot of like numerous kind of, I call them side plots within like these mini heresies, stuff we'll cover later, like John, like where he tries to murder Malkador, all these weird
things. I'll give you one of the most powerful things that Erebus does, or his abilities, is this dude must have a Hoover level of dirt on everybody. He knows everybody's flaws, and he knows all the interpersonal.
Zinch.
Yeah, he knows all the interpersonal conflicts of people too. Any Primarch on Primarch mojo, anything like that, he's right up on top of it and is very effective at starting shit, basically. Yeah. He is galactic shit starter.
He works this area very well. And then there's Cor Farron, who just kind of sucks at this stage. He's Luther.
I was about to say, there's no chance you're going to like a character if you think he's basically the Diet Coke of Luther.
He is. That's what this guy is. He pulls off, he becomes Starscream, effectively, where everything he tries, he constantly pulls defeat from the jaws of victory over and over and over again. I don't like Cor Farron. All right, but let's get to the calling of the legions. The lead up to Istvan, the Istvans plural, the word bearers themselves had their own little split. So Lorgar, having like seen and met with the force of chaos, sees them as the future of humanity and as inevitable. Erebus and Cor Farron are less aligned with this inevitability, mostly Erebus, but he's just able to influence Cor Farron. And so one of the major challenges that the Horus is going to face is actually the rebellion from within. Because we're talking about 200 years between the start of the Great Crusade and the outset of Horus Heresy, okay? In that period of time, a lot of the Terran-born legionaries have died, but an overwhelming chunk of them still exist. And even amongst the non-Terran-born, there's a lot of them who are loyal to the Emperor. Horus cannot wage a war while also fighting within his own legion of people who were like, no, I'm not turning traitor. So Erebus, not Lorgar, Erebus comes to him with a plan. And Erebus was about to basically move himself out of the word bearers into a much larger role in general.
Which is basically making the heresy start from the warrior lodges. Things didn't work out for my warrior lodges. Yes, I'm well aware.
It's because they're a terrible idea. Because anytime someone says to you, hey, don't worry, it's a safe space, you can speak freely here, they are writing that crap down. Do not do that. All right, fine, if you're in therapy, do it. Don't get me wrong. But outside of that, this isn't therapy. When someone's like, oh no, everyone here's cool, man, you can say whatever you want. Enjoy the blackmail. That's what's coming right afterwards. It's like, that's on you. If you fall for that when you get blackmailed, that's on you.
So he starts a big movement of categorizing who's gonna be a problem and who's not. And then he also starts to... Really, the insidious part is as soon as he finds out who's going to be a problem to all the people that he thinks are going to be able to commit over to the heresy, he starts effectively bad-mouthing those people with personal problems that people have with them.
Yep.
To get them against those people.
And what's interesting about Erebus' stage is Erebus starts moving himself up to being a major confidant of Horus, to the point that later in the heresy, he actually will kind of supplant Abaddon. In that regard, Abaddon is still Horus's number one warrior, but Erebus has, I think, more influence. And that's also why Abaddon hated Erebus.
Oh, yeah.
Hated Erebus. Now, Istvan III occurs. We've covered that before. Giant calling of the legions. But the word bearers weren't part of that. The word bearers, they need to be. They'd already called their own legion
you know,
years ago,
over the last,
decades. We got to talk about this because there was a shadow revolution going on from the original when he blew up their gem of a city, when that they started right then. Like there was, they had the fake, we're trying to redeem ourselves, we're going to be the best chapter. And the shadow war was going on with them calling out anybody that wasn't going to the new way that the Legion was going. And that happened almost immediately upon that.
Exactly. And so by the time we get to Istvan III, the Legion has been cleaned up from the Word Bearers. But this also means that they're still listed as loyal. So when the call goes out to, hey, we got a bunch of traitors, can someone help us out? When the Word Bearers volunteer, it makes a lot more sense than say, I don't know, the Night Lords in accepting their help. Because the truth is, yes, they've been erecting monuments to a god all over the place, but the god was the emperor, so it feels like they're probably loyal. Oops. Now, the events of Istvan V don't go great for Lorgar. Here's what I'll say. I've been thinking about this a lot. It's a little bit complicated. There's two ways I think you can look at Lorgar when we look at from this point on through the rest of the heresy. He either is just the bad guy to get his ass kicked. That's what happens a lot. He keeps getting close to getting his ass kicked and over again. Or he's an allegory to chaos in that hubris.
Is the fault.
I prefer that one. Yeah, because I think of it a lot of it as like the idea being that Lorgar is a favorite of chaos. And he just interprets, well, obviously I will be the best because I'm a favorite of chaos. But he doesn't understand, in that hubris, he fails to remember chaos is chaotic. And they don't actually, they will be fickle.
They're mercurial. They will give you power and take it away at the same time and or turn away from you and not save you yet.
Yeah. And a great example of this is on Istvan V. On Istvan V, they kick off and Lorgar comes strolling forth to attack the loyalists, supported by the Gal Vorbach, you know, his possessed. And the idea is that I'm going to go kill me a Primarch. And he comes upon a very tired, but also pretty angry Korax.
Who's also strapping on. He's got the old pump up boots of mighty ass kicking.
Yeah.
He's put a few pumps in. And he Chuck Norris roundhouse kicks Lorgar into another dimension and all of the Gal Vorbach.
Yeah, Lorgar versus the Raven, because that's his actual name, doesn't go great. The Gal Vorbach are actually, to be fair, the Gal Vorbach are wrecking the Raven Guard Space Marines until Korax sees them and goes, yeah, I'm not about that.
Yeah.
And flies
they
over.
They did what they did before Korax came to Tau.
Yeah. All of them except for Argal Tau die in basically an instant. Lorgar rushes over, infused with chaos powers, to just get punched right in the mouth. Like immediately too. And is on the back foot. And Korax is about to kill him when, of course, Conrad shows up. Because Conrad can fight. And Lorgar is saved. The events on the surface, though, seem to stun Lorgar a little bit. This goes back to my opinion earlier. I think of Lorgar as thinking, I am the favorite of chaos. Hell, I went and had a chat with them. They obviously will support me. I will be invincible. And then just got his ass kicked. Bad, too. Not like it was a close fight. It was a middle schooler fighting a college
Thunderdome.
Yeah.
Also, Korax
brutal.
Told him that he was going to hunt him down and murder him, so. Which he's still trying.
Yeah, which he's still trying to do, which is nice of him. What happens, though, is Lorgar gets the call, get up here on the ship, and he comes back on to, Vengeful Spirit. And as soon as Lorgar walks in the room, he looks over. Yep, he gets in the room, he looks over, and Fulgrim's there. But this is the Fulgrim who's possessed by a demon.
From his blade.
And immediately, Lorgar attacks. Doesn't explain why. He just attacks Fulgrim, trying to kill it, because he knows what's really going on. This is my brother. There's a demon in here. And it's an odd thing, because Lorgar, again, is not pro-demon. Erebus would have been like, this is awesome. High-five him.
Yep.
But Lorgar is not cool with this. Interestingly, though, Horus sees this, breaks up the fight, and kicks everyone out of the room except for Fulgrim and Lorgar. And explains to him, yeah, look, I know there's a demon pissing Fulgrim, but, you know,
Let's see what happens, right? And Lorgar is just horrified by this, to the point where in the novel, Horus puts his hand on Lorgar's shoulder and says, hey, man, you know, basically be cool. And Lorgar uses his psychic powers to make Horus take his hand off of his shoulder, which Horus is not all that thrilled, by the way.
I do think this is because he doesn't think that there was any way that they would try to take one of their chosen, possess them and treat them like this. And he's like, what happens if that happened to me effectively? They don't say that. I inferred that.
Yeah, that's a good interpretation. I saw it more as just like a, like this, in effect, we shouldn't be around them. I think Lorgar doesn't seem to be serving the Chaos Gods as part of it too. I think he sees them as serving him, but that's a side note. There's another novel here, by the way, just for the note, called Aurelian. Some really cool stuff in that one. So Lorgar, once again later, rejoins Horus on the bridge to hear the directions. And Horus has laid out this magnificent trap for the Ultramarines. He's told Yelaman Ultramarines that there's an impending orc invasion on the world of Kalth. And that's in the Viridium sector within Ultramar. And Gilliman's mustered almost all of his forces there. And Horus is sending Lorgar there with the word bearers to assist them
in the pacification of the orcs.
Yep. Now, because of a ruin storm, Gilliman doesn't know about Istvan 3 and Istvan 5. So there's no communication going on. Lorgar is told, all right, attack the Ultramarines on Kalth and just cripple their forces. And Lorgar goes, yeah, no. Not no to the whole plan, but I have a better plan. He says, I'm only going to put half my forces in the Kalth. The rest of my forces are going to attack all of Ultramar. And Horus, being the war master, and he does know his stuff, goes, that's a terrible idea. Like, you will get ruined if you try and do that. You can't split your legion in half. To which Lorgar goes, okay, then give me a second legion. And with that, Lorgar and Angrond headed to Ultramar. Now, as we open the cast up, Brad talked about talking crap on the Ultramarines, but I don't know. I wrote the notes. Let's see how this goes. So, Kalth, Lorgar, Erebus, and Cor-Faron are all aligning what's going to happen next. Although, different paths come into this. Cor-Faron's path sucked. Side note. They were never going to defeat the Ultramarines. They couldn't.
They didn't need to defeat them. That wasn't what they were trying to do, though.
Horus wanted them to.
Yeah, sure.
Horus wanted them.
They were not there for that. They had a different plan.
Yeah. Their plan was to use a ruin storm, create enough problems and issues that a ruin storm would kick up, and that would effectively cut the galaxy in half, which would separate Baal, Ultramar, all these areas from Sol, making it impossible for them to get there. It was going to start out of Ultramar. So the first plan was to go to Kalth. The Ultramarine fleet were there, and they were waiting for the word bearers to arrive. They arrived late, which I can just imagine Gilliman just being over the moon with anger, like a Swiss train conductor, like waiting on foreigners. Just like, how dare you be late? And he does get angrier once the word bearers do what they do next, but he does start off pretty pissed off, just calling it out. We have in the past, I should note here, taken a lot of dumps all over the word bearers. And it's because their plans tend to fall apart in the end just due to incompetence or hubris.
But their plans have to fall apart. Otherwise, we go, and credits roll because they're...
The end. Yeah. Exactly.
These plans don't really fall apart, though. They kind of achieve most of what they're trying to achieve.
They do because Cor-Faron jacks it up, and we'll get there.
Yeah.
But in Kalth, it starts off really well. Their plan was to attack the Ultramarines and create carnage. While Erebus does his whole giant sacrifice and starts with, by the way, a lot of cultists.
Yes, I was saying, he creates one of the biggest rituals to go down.
So in the onset, war bearers do great. They infiltrate as friends a bunch of ships and orbital platforms all on Kalth and then murder the crews there and take them over. They then get control of the defensive platforms, installing scrap codes, the demon-infused scrap codes. Everything's in place. And they begin their attack. And I love this because when the attack begins, Gilliman assumes the word bearers are just incompetent, is why they're firing on his legion. Like they got the controls mixed up and things were backwards. That's how little he thinks the word bearers, that he's just convinced they're not firing on us on purpose. They're just idiots.
He doesn't get the information. You got to figure that Kalth is a huge battle, but Kalth's sister planets get wrecked. And they just nuke them into some, just
they do.
Gone.
Well, and this is the story gets stupid, but kind of funny, because out of eventually Lorgar and them do a full blown attack and they do an orbital bombardment on Kalth, killing millions in an instant. At which point Gilliman realizes, oh, you're attacking me. And he calls Lorgar and starts ripping him a new a-hole over this, about how I'm going to kill you when this, I'm going to personally pull your arms out of their sockets. At which point Lorgar does this weird thing. So the whole time that the word bearers are attacking the Ultramarines are hailing them saying, hey, stop shooting us. Hey, stop shooting us. And the word bearers are responding with silence. As soon as Gilliman starts shit talking Lorgar, Lorgar flips the switch on
and gives him the Incredibles. You almost caught me monologuing.
Yeah. Oh my God. He does a full monologue telling Gilliman all the details of Horus's betrayal, Istvan, everything, for no reason, by the way. Just starts telling him all this stuff. And while he's giving his way, Erebus, this is my theory, just starts casting fast. Like, oh, shit. Now we're in it. But after Lorgar does his little speech of here's everything's going on, he then, Gilliman's shield is still
thrown down. You have to give him props on this.
Yeah.
He talks a wild amount of shit. And then immediately puts a summoning portal on the bridge of Gilliman's ship.
And a bunch of demons appear and end up blowing a hole in it, sucking Gilliman into space. To which Lorgar goes full Dr. Evil and just leaves. Like, oh,
it'll all work out.
Probably dead. What could go wrong? Gilliman goes Princess Leia, episode 8. Yeah, I said it. Yeah, I know. That's what I did. Just would make everyone upset. Traveling through. That was one of the... Oof, that seems that hard to watch.
Suck. But...
Yeah, anyway. But he is helmetless in space, soloing demons and word bears are trying to kill him until he basically walks back into another ship going, hey, I lost my ship. Can I have this one? All the Ultramarines like, I mean, yeah, they're kind of all yours if you want it. But at the same time, Cor Farron has taken control of the word bearers in Kalth, and things were looking great. But again, Cor Farron is Luther. The Ultramarines were taken by surprise. The word bearers had control or destroyed a lot of the orbital platforms. Gilliman's flagship is ruined.
I need you. I want to put this part, because when I was getting ready for this episode, going through the notes, John has, oh yeah, the demon Samus was partying on Kalth. For whatever reason, in my mind, and it's still stuck in my mind, is this giant demon that's DJing a party.
Oh, DJ. I was thinking more he had glow sticks while he was
could have. I was thinking DJ though. Like he's got Tiesto next to him rocking. Yeah. They're just doing
Samus is just having a time
but
on call.
Like, the party is the best thing is ever. Him just slaughtering people.
Yeah. Kalth isn't going great. But the Ultramarines then Ultramarine. They take a look around and go, all right, we're on our back foot. But it is the word bearers, so I think we got this. And they just start finding all the holes in the word bearers, start counterattacking.
I think that Cor Farron is a terrible. He wasn't even a good master of faith. He was Cor Farron. As much as you hate Luther, I think Cor Farron is just such a failure because he's also
they're equals. They're both useless.
He's just so also, pointless. It's just that you've got the side guys that are next to the Primarch, and Erebus is doing this comically evil stuff, but he's got great plans. Cor Farron's plans suck. They've always sucked. They always will suck. He just fails every single time.
And to be fair, like Cor Farron is a dude who they gave a bunch of PEDs to make a space marine. And he's trying to out-strategy Gilliman. Gilliman was going to defeat Lorgar in this one, but Lorgar might be able to hold up for a little bit because this is a Primarch. The processing power between these two aren't even close. So Gilliman starts winning the battles. At the same time, one of the Majoses with the Ultramarines figures out basically a cure to the scrap code. So he says, hey, if we keep the orbital platforms, because what I didn't mention the word bearers were also doing was trying to destroy the moon. I'm mixing up my movies. Just trying to destroy the sun
by putting
of Kalth.
Well, they kind
by
of
firing
do,
all the orbital platforms. Not they're trying to supernova the thing.
Yeah, but they poison the radiation for forever off of it. So
yeah, it's not going to go great. And so Gilliman, they discover, hey, if we just go down to these Oracle platforms, we can install this new code and it'll stop it. So Gilliman leads the charge down there. They're wrecking on one of the Oracle platforms. Corpharon sees this and goes, I'm going to do something about this, loser. He gets down there and he does successfully, using warp-powered psychics, drop Gilliman pretty quickly. It temporarily paralyzes him. And he goes to run over to kill him, but instead of trying to kill Gilliman, the Corpharon's he just sucks.
He was so super jealous of Erebus. Exactly. He wanted to show he could do it even better and make it happen. So he stabs Bobby G, and Bobby G...
Well, he stabs him with a demon-infused blade that's meant to turn Bobby G over, to put him the same thing. The problem is Bobby G just fully resists it. It's like, yeah,
Good to hear.
Yeah, and pulls off a Kali Ma in return on Corpharon by punching a hole in his chest and pulling one of his hearts out.
I do love this. They do describe this in detail.
Yeah, he uses the claws of his power fist to go through Corpharon's power armor into his body and pulls one of the hearts out while looking at him with the sword stuck in him going like, what else you got, bitch? Corpharon does then run away, very quickly runs away. But Gilliman's got a problem. And the problem he's got is he's got two things happening at once. Yes, they stop the sun going supernova, but it is firing off so much radiation.
You're going to have to use SPF 22,000.
Yeah. At the same time, on Kalth, you've got word bearers and demons wrecking. But Gilliman also sees the ruin storm closing. So he orders as much evacuation of Kalth as he can get and tells everyone else to go underground. And we're going to fight underground because with all the radiation, even the radiation so high, even a space marine in power armor couldn't survive this. Now, what I do like about this is that, first off, the people of Kalth, they do eventually win this battle. They do this because they're ultramarines, and of course they're going to win it, but also Gilliman comes back later during the scouring. However, the battle for Kalth is not technically concluded yet because he got converted over to a crusade. And the crusade will only end when every single word bearer is dead. Ultramarines took some offense to that.
The word bearers were successful in this. They did make a maelstrom.
Yeah. At the same time, this also will mark the end of Corpharon in the Horus Heresy, because while Corpharon escaped with his only one remaining heart and got to a ship, Gilliman decided that ship wasn't leaving the galaxy. And he begins chasing the ship down with his thing and just starts destroying it. But before it can be destroyed, Corpharon opens up a portal and takes himself to the planet within the warp called the Sicarius, which is a demon world within the Eye of Terror. And we'll cover it later, will later become the homeworld for the word bearers. But that's the end of, this is the end of Corpharon, the Horus Heresy. He's gone now. Yep. He will not reappear. Now, let's jump back to Lorgar. Lorgar did not leave Kalth as a coward.
No, he had a plan.
He had a much, and a good one, actually. His plan was that the Ruinstorm Erebus was going to make over there was going to be big, but it needs more fuel. So his idea was, I'll make that Ruinstorm so large, the galaxy will be cut in half. Ultramar does sit in the lower right portion of the galaxy, but a storm here could separate so much of the Imperium's holdings, but more importantly, it'll separate him, Gilliman, it'll separate Ball, and it will separate a little bit of the Dark Angels. So it just severs a giant chunk, which is critical for this war effort. Horus can travel, and his force can travel in the warp even during a ruin storm because the chaos gods control the ruin storm. Basically, yeah, they'll allow it. The Imperium cannot. So the loyalists would get trapped. His idea is just a giant campaign of slaughter. The word bearers would be the first line of the insult. And then after the ultimate emplacements, the world leaders in Angron would then go in and just wrecking all, and they're just killing stuff while word bearer sorcerers are behind them, effectively channeling the death. So during this campaign of slaughter, where they're just feeding all this death into the warp, Lorgar notices Angron's losing himself.
Well, he's not just losing. Angron's not losing himself. Like, he can't stay focused. The butcher's nails are killing Angron. He is going to die from them.
Yeah, Angron's going to die. And so Lorgar makes a plan to save Angron. What's interesting, though, is at the exact same time, Erebus learns of Khorne's plan for Karn. So both the Primarch and Erebus leave Ultramar to head back to the World Leader's home of Nusaria to aid their respective champions in their ascensions. We cover this in the World Leader's class, so I don't have to go too much into it, but they get to Nusaria and Angron discovers that the slavers that had controlled him had killed all his friends and then had shit-talked him as a coward after he left. So he decides to kill everyone.
That's my first literal in a while. I'm doing so good about not saying it 100 times in a row. I'm so proud of myself. I'd pat myself on the back if I didn't have little T-Rex arms.
It's also just bad shoulders, too.
You go with any of those.
It's a combo of both.
Check all. Little column A, little column B.
So while Angron's doing this murder fest, Lorgar is building a ritual pit just over there. Not too long into this, the Ultramarines arrive in orbit because Gilliman wasn't overly pleased with what the World Leaders and Word Bearers had been doing on Ultramar. He thought, you know what?
He was like, I was going to do a strongly worded email, but I think I'm just going to show up instead.
Yeah, I have a plan, and you guys aren't going to like my plan. Yeah, the first couple things happen. First, Gilliman confronts Lorgar as it's beating the crap out of him. And just as Gilliman's about to kill Lorgar, Angron jumps him.
I have to give a little bit of shit on your boy because he starts fighting Angron eventually here on a comical X from Acme. He's literally sitting above the boulder that the coyote has tied over top of it.
I do love this next part though. As Angron and Gilliman are fighting, Lorgar pulls off his ritual. And Angron turns into a full demon Primarch in front of Gilliman. And to Gilliman's credit, Gilliman at that moment goes, yeah, nah, like, nah, this is a bit much. I'm going to go ahead and go home now. There's weight classes to these fights. And this is not above mine. Yeah, exactly. The featherweights don't fight super heavies just in general. I'm going to go figure something out. I'll be back, but I'm not doing this right now. And he goes to leave. While all this is happening, though, a much more important thing happens with Erebus and Karn. Argel Tal, as we mentioned before, and Lorgar, they've been bonding quite a bit. Argel has been possessed by a demon, but not like controlled. And the demon's name is Realm. Him and Realm are kind of sharing.
Well, Argel is convinced that this is all how it should be. And
what I like, though, is Argel and Realm almost befriend each other. I mean, he has conversations with the demon in that's possessing his body with him. So they share control. It's not like Fulgrim, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Argal is a great warrior. And with the demon infusion, one of the things, it made him even better. And so one thing he'd been doing is he'd been going to the fighting pits within the World Eaters to test his skills. And he and Karn had built a friendship there. They're dueling and laughing together, like a buddy cop movie, but instead they're horrible space marines.
A buddy cop movie, except they slaughter innocents constantly.
Yeah, it's not, I know they're good cops. Erebus, though, is not a huge fan of Argel Tal. As we said before, he recruited Argel, but Argel kind of betrayed him at the recruitment. And Argel's now getting very close to Lorgar. And that's affecting Erebus's ability to influence Lorgar. But the biggest problem is Argel and Karn's friendship is going to be a problem because Erebus knows that Karn is a chosen favored of Khorne. And so Erebus has a plan. The irony, by the way, is that Lorgar is helping Angron become like the demon prince for Khorne. Erebus knows who Khorne really wants, though, which is Karn.
We have stated this. There's multiple favorites of the gods that are not the Primarch.
Yeah. Karn, I think, is the most extreme. It's Karn and Typhus.
Typhus is most wildly more tied to.
I don't know. I think Karn is, though. If you think about like what Typhus does versus what Karn does, Karn is the most Khorne thing ever. Yeah. Typhus is pro-Nurgle. But it's not like Karn.
I just didn't talk shit to Mortarion about how he is.
So does Karn, though. So does Karn. And Karn's just, I don't know, Karn's just a lot cool. But whatever. Karn's cooler is kind of my thing. But anyway, the issue is that Erebus realized that Argal Tal and Karn, their friendship, is giving Karn joy in the universe, which is something that'll keep Karn in the Materium. He needs Karn to only see the value of slaughter for the Blood God. So as this battle, it's a great story of how awful Erebus is, by the way. So the battle in Noceria is commencing, and Erebus goes to Argal Tal and says, hey, Karn's in danger. You need to go save him because the Ultramans are going to kill him. And that Karn will die here on Noceria to the forces of the Ultramarines. And Argal is both a hell of a warrior and a good friend of Karn. So he just rushes off to go save him. Him and his demon buddy, Raum. So they start slaughtering all these Ultramarines, killing them by the dozens, just ripping through. And eventually he does meet up with Karn, who is in trouble, to be fair. This wasn't a lie. Karn was in trouble. And they then fight side by side. I think they should fight back to back at one point, which is stupid as shit, that's a side note, because there's bullets. But anyway, and they're doing this whole thing. But after the battle, Argal is standing there and Erebus reappears. Really good scene in the book in which Erebus starts to talk to Argal about Karn. About how, yeah, I have great hope for the eighth captain.
I love over this. And over again. Because Rom is just going, no, stab this dude in the face.
Immediately. Rom is freaking out inside of Argal's head, screaming, kill him, kill him. It was a trap. He tricked us to using up all of our energy. Kill him now. And Argal's telling Rom, shut up. I'm trying to listen to Erebus. And as turns around, Erebus jams the anathema dagger into Argal's spine, killing him. And he tells him as he dies that he has to die so that one day Karn may truly ascend. Now, fun thing on that, though. So Argal's dead. Everyone finds Argal dead. Lorgar, not a big fan of this, tells Karn, like, hey, you know, your best friend
weird, by the way.
in the entire galaxy, yeah, Erebus stabbed in the back. To which Karn challenges Erebus to a duel in the fighting pits. And Erebus goes, yeah, man, sure, let's party. And the two of them have a duel. And Karn is beating the ever-living crap out of Erebus.
Erebus knows he has zero chance. This is all a setup in this, too.
Because Erebus is, in effect, doing the Star Wars Sith Lord thing. Was showing the power of anger and slaughter. And as he's getting walloped by Karn. He is just before he's able to kill him, he just makes a portal and disappears. He goes, all right, I'm out. And Karn's left on the bridge, like, still angry. And Erebus, like, exactly. Now, this is the part where Lorgar, though, also turns on Horus. At this stage,
Lorgar really thinks that he is the Chosen of Chaos and should be in charge because he is the Chosen of Chaos. He's the one that's going to bring the galaxy under the thumb of the Chaos Gods. I should be running this. I discovered them. I know the truth. Mm-hmm. I'm bringing them into the galaxy.
I also think part of it is, to defend Lorgar, I think he recognizes that Horus is becoming a puppet 100%. Of the Chaos Gods, and Lorgar is not. And he actually is not.
Yes, well, that's the thing with Lorgar. I think that all of this changed when he saw that Fulgrim was possessed. And when the gods are just taking over, what are you doing? You know, lead like I do.
The interesting thing to me here is I think of Lorgar at this stage as very similar to Abaddon later. Where Abaddon later goes, all right, I don't trust any of these Chaos Gods, but I do need them. So I'm going to figure out a way to work around them and with them, but not for them. Lorgar sees that Horus is failing in that. And he knows that the Dark Gods will eventually pull Horus in different directions because the Dark Gods aren't going to be satisfied with defeating the Emperor. They're only going to be satisfied with one of them also being the victor. Because Lorgar knows this. Horus doesn't. So Lorgar decides it's time for a leadership change. The heresy was started by Horus, but it was going to be finished by Lorgar. Meanwhile, Erebus has known all that the entire goddamn time. Erebus has known the entire time this is not about Horus. In fact, Horus will probably get consumed by the Chaos Gods. Erebus just wants to see the Imperium fall and Chaos win. So he goes the other direction, whereas Lorgar says, I have to supplant Horus and take over. Erebus goes, I have to be a better puppeteer of Horus.
That's a better plan, but also there wasn't another plan for him. He's not a Primarch. They're not following him.
There's not. And so what he does is he decides the weekend at Burn.
I love everything about that. Which is kind of what's going on.
It really is. Horus is half conscious for the next like chunk of it. And Erebus he said this.
I mean, Abaddon gets so pissed when he sees the end version of Horus, which is one of my favorites.
Oh, it's incredible. He's just ashamed of him. And Abaddon still wants to kill Erebus. But that's where we're going to break now. And we're going to break because next week we're going to cover, we'll finish this off next week with Word Bearers, the conclusion of the heresy, and then their actions post-heresy. Because as we get now into the later part of the heresy, Lorgar is about to get a pretty solid kick in the teeth. Really bad one, actually. But also post-heresy, they're one of the more active of the Chaos Legion.
They stay active, too.
Because, yeah, they don't, some of the guys just disappear for a while. Not White Scars disappear, but like...
But I say it because it's one of my first things that I played in 40K way back then. Mm-hmm. I was telling you before the cast, I played World Eaters, I played Iron Warriors, and I played Word Bearers because they were one of the most prolific summoners.
Because they were OP. We know how you play the game.
What? Nothing wrong with that. They had cool lore, though. I literally started with lore.
The Word Bearers have... The Word Bearers have they're so influential. That's what makes them cool. It's like reading about World War I and being like, oh, wow, these guys just were involved in everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so until next week, John Barsotti, Brad Chester.
This guy.
See you guys then.